Hey everybody, welcome to our next session, which is Startup Law and Getting Started. We are going to be discussing some of the legal sides and just really, you know, when you get started with your company, it's easy to kind of move fast and break things, like we've heard other people say. But you don't want to break things too much because you can cause a lot of problems for yourself down the road. You know, everything from your intellectual property to, you know, if you're in a regulated space, to even like the fundraising mechanism that you use, right? Like, are you doing public solicitations when you shouldn't be publicly soliciting? So those are the things we're going to talk about. And so with that, I'd love to introduce our two guests. Jill, could you introduce yourself first, please?
Hi, I look like I'm not centered. I'm Jill Williamson. I'm an attorney here in Seattle. With Gravis Law, and I specialize in sort of gray emerging tech, regulatory, and just general startup and early stage company business law.
Bob.
I'm Bob Cornish. I'm an attorney with Anderson Kill in Washington, D.C. I handle securities and corporate work for fund managers, advisors, and family offices. I'm also quite involved in the blockchain space. I'm a member of the Wyoming Blockchain Coalition and have had the opportunity to author and contribute to some of the legislation in the state.
Excellent, excellent. Well, let's just kick off with startups, right? So I'm a founder, you know, in a hypothetical sense. So I'm a founder, you know, I have an idea, and I start articulating and showcasing that idea to other people. You know, there becomes instances where if I'm ideating or working on that idea with someone else for periods of time, or they're now contributing work, they perhaps have ownership of this, right? Can you kind of touch on that, kind of like the importance of making sure that you are putting your flag on the ground, or you know, what you should be doing before you really start working on your idea with other people?
I personally love the word ideating, because that is a word that practically illustrates the evolution of an idea into something that starts crossing into the neverland of legalese and that supreme moment of unction where an entrepreneur says, gee, maybe it's time for me to call a lawyer and figure out what it is that I really need to be doing. Because somewhere along the line, that idea becomes, say, I'm working with someone else. You know, you start becoming Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble as a joint venture, right? You're going down the road doing your thing. And liabilities under state corporate laws start to attach as to things that you're doing and things that you're saying. And then suddenly you're dealing with issues of property, you're dealing with issues of corporate governance, and then ultimately the granddaddy of them all is you're going to start raising money. And, you know, all of that ideating suddenly turns to a critical mass. And there's a lot of self-reflection that entrepreneurs, I think, really need to take when they're working on those sorts of things and ideas, when they suddenly get to that critical mass. The idea has to be real. It has to be genuine. You know, I don't think anybody on this video screen is thinking about, you know, tokenizing nuclear power or anything where they're totally out to lunch and haven't thought about the regulatory framework of things. But even for the most adept entrepreneur, there are chutes and ladders that you need to be aware of after you ideate.
So, yeah, I think, you know, both Bob and I don't want to speak for Bob, but we're, you know, a little bit older than your average blockchain founder. And, you know, for me, the sort of radical openness and transparency with which a lot of blockchain founders operate is a little bit crazy. it took a bit of an adjustment for me to get used to, you know, going to a meetup and having every founder openly discuss their, you know, groundbreaking idea with all of the other founders in, you know, in an open forum, which, you know, because the lawyer in me is like, protect that, don't tell, these are secrets. And so, you know, Jonathan, you know, like a few things come to mind for me when you talk about, you know, being a founder, having an idea, getting together, working with somebody or just kicking it around. And one of them is just protecting your idea. You know, if it is a genuinely unique and creative idea, honestly, within the law, there are, you know, you can do NDAs, you can do trademarks or copyright applications. There are things that you can do that we like to think will provide protection. But as a practical matter, in order to enforce those protections, it either requires a standard of proof you often won't have. Like, how do you prove that somebody else stole your idea and got to market before you did, just because you were at some of the same meetings? Where's the evidence? How do you prove that? Or it involves an expense to litigate, which you don't have the money for. So, you know, it's great to have an NDA, but how do you enforce it? You enforce it by going to court and suing somebody and proving that they stole your information and used it in a way that they are not allowed to. So, and I'll also have to admit that my formative adult years were spent in intelligence. And so I am a little bit more secretive than the average bear. But the number one way that you protect your idea is not to tell anybody about it. Even with an NDA, even with a copyright, you know, patent, you know, that's a little bit safer, but it's still, you have to enforce it. So even with the best legal bells and whistles in place, if you don't have cash in your pocket, you're vulnerable and that idea can be stolen. And I'm not trying to discourage people from sharing, but I want them to do so mindfully and being cognizant of the risk.
Right. I mean, I think the way to think about it is, like, you know, don't share the things that you wouldn't want someone to copy. Right. So if you're saying, like, oh, I'm creating a social network and it's going to be for a particular subset of humans, right? Like, you know, that you're giving someone a broad range of what you're doing, but you're not really sharing your IP. But then if you start saying, like, yeah, like, we're this social network, the only way that you can log in is through this, like, really interesting, like, I don't know, facial recognition thing that does this other thing, that does this other thing, you know, like, now you're starting to, you know, unpack what is it, show them how the sausage is made,
right?
Which is a little bit different. You know, I've heard of scenarios where people are ideating on idea and perhaps the company hasn't been formed yet. And so sure enough, someone starts and one of them forms the company, goes off with it. And then someone comes back and says, well, I own a quarter of this idea. You know, I haven't done anything other than, like, the original ideation part, but, you know, I own some of this, right? Have either of you walked into that before or seen that?
I did. I had a client a few years ago that spent a lot of time talking to someone who wanted to be a joint venture partner, who promised that they would deliver. They were not a technical partner, more in the business development and expertise, introductions, that sort of thing. And, I was in and out as counsel because they, you know, didn't have a ton of cash. So I wasn't across all of the correspondence and, you know, the different, but they went round and round with drafts of agreements and went to meetings together and, you know, did, you know, had regular conversations, but at the end of the day, never signed an agreement and never could agree on terms. They did a seed round. The seed investors, you know, the potential joint venture partner didn't like the offer from the seed investors. And, you know, at the end of the day, they were out. You know, the position that the company and the seed investors, and frankly, my position was, you didn't have a deal. You know, you were continuing up to the last minute to negotiate what the terms of your partnership would be, and you never agreed. And, you know, until you're out. But it's still risky. You know, they could have sued. Even to defend the lawsuit, even if you're right, costs money. So, you know, being the lawyer, you know, I'd rather have it in writing sooner than later. Even if it's just a framework that's subject to amendment as things develop and grow. Because you don't know today everything that you might want or the way everything should work in a year, but you can still put like a broad framework in place. Just so that you have written down and agreed on what the expectations of both sides are. You know, in the end, it's been a couple of years, we haven't heard anything, it's probably went away. But it could have been at least an expensive lawsuit for them to defend, which would have been unfortunate and, you know, would not have been a good use of their seed funds.
Most definitely.
You know, I've dealt with that sort of issue where somebody comes to me and says, I've contributed all of these things to this nascent venture. This person is on the verge of doing something large, and I am going to be shut out. What am I supposed to do? First thing I tell them is, you are as good in terms of legal stead as you know, the jilted girlfriend or boyfriend under the law. There's something called the heartbomb action that generally is kind of like an alienation of affection claim that aren't recognized in the law anymore. They were at one point, but not in the 21st century. And that goes for people who are hanging out with entrepreneurs and venture capital wannabes as well. Unless you are really tied at the hip with somebody and you have something to show that you're actually, you know, doing something on paper. Maybe somebody has recognized you as a co-founder. Maybe somebody has written to people or prepared a pitch deck saying that you're in the deal. It's really hard to say that you have a stake in anything that other person is doing. So, you know, that's a hard dose of reality for a lot of people to swallow, you know, when, you know, we're going down the merry way of creating things and changing the world. The last thing we want to think about is, by gosh, is this person that I'm hitching my wagon to gonna, you know, push me off the cliff? Nobody wants to think that way. And most entrepreneurs don't think that way, and they probably shouldn't think that way because they're going to be the ones taking risks. But on the other hand, people need to go in to these things eyes wide open, knowing that there is going to be some point when this ideation, as you say, ultimately becomes something very real and requires some documentation. It's not terribly difficult to do, but you know, you'd be surprised how many times people come to you, and Jill probably has the same thing, like, let's do a partnership agreement. Well, what do you want in it? Well, I want to control the company. Well, how about so-and-so? What do they say about it? Oh, they don't have any issues with it. You know, 2 weeks later, I can't believe this person is shutting me out of the company. I don't have any voting rights. You know, you start seeing the tensions and things where people believe that they have, you know, power over others. And you have to address those human realities in the way you conduct yourself. It's not easy to do. People are people. We're, you know, they're gonna, you know, as much as we want to say, you know, everyone's gonna help each other out, I mean, there's ultimately self-interest that is at the hub of a lot of these things. And at some point, somebody has the opportunity to either be a team player or not be on the team at all. And our job as attorneys is when these two, you know, venture people, these venture folks come to us and look for guidance and solace, I guess, in the way they want to run their business. It really becomes more of almost a therapy session and sorts where people are trying to explain how much they've given to the relationship and how much they are entitled to. And then, somewhere along the line, everyone finds some common ground to find what makes everyone happy and will allow the venture to continue. So I guess, there's just a lot of, self-reflection that needs to be taken into account when you're going down this road, and just recognizing the fact that there is a time to pull the trigger and talk to an attorney, and there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of natural tension when you are starting a company or an idea and it's turning, right? And you start to think about equity. You start carving up equity, right? And so, I'm always nervous when I hear of people doing 50-50 because I feel like they're not having the tough conversation then, right? If it's like, oh, well, it's 50-50, most likely there's one person that's putting a little bit more time than the other, or there might be one person that's more valuable to the business than the other, right? Like, not always, but I would say in more often than not, that's the case. So, sometimes I've heard people say things like, oh, don't worry about equity to start, and then kind of like determine that equity later. That seems like that could also be problematic though, because of what you're talking about. Like, we all value our own contributions, perhaps higher than other people do. And that's probably across any relationship that we've had our entire life. Like, right. So, what do founders do there? Do they have a equity agreement and then, be amendable to changing that? Is that just not a thing? Or do they just, 50-50 if you can't think about it? What do you both advise in those types of scenarios? Jill, you want to take that first?
Sure. I mean, I said earlier, I disliked 50-50 because there's really no way to resolve a disagreement. We're talking worst case scenario. We're talking at when the founders are at a place where they're not having constructive conversations, when they can't work an issue through, they still own a company and have an obligation to that company to run it. And if you both have equal rights to decision making and you can't talk and you can't be constructive and you can't agree, there's no legal way to resolve that. So I'm not a fan. That said, you can have 50-50 equity without having 50-50 power. So, and I think that's one reason that it might be good to talk to an attorney, because I think people get into their heads that their options are more limited than they actually are. Worst example of why you should get these things in writing, it wasn't a tech company, it was a roofing company. But, the father had given the son 30%. They didn't have an operating agreement. And so, 10 years later, the relationship had gone south. The son wants out. The father says, you're fired, you have nothing. But under the law, they were equal partners because they didn't have an operating agreement. So they both had equal powers over the company at that point because they were both members and there was no operating agreement. So, and it got so bad, I'm not going to lie. Like, the father got out a gun. I literally had to go to court and get a restraining order against the father. Now that is an extreme situation, but with an operating agreement, they would have been able to go to court and force a settlement and force an action, to dissolve the company and give the son his 30%. Instead, they were out, godly amounts of attorney's fees, and then we, and restraining orders and guns and threats, and because they had no basis with which to resolve their disagreement. And, you know, and so, and that's an example where he only had 30% equity, but he had equal power.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, you can have the opposite. You can have unequal power, but equal ownership.
Right.
There are lots of different ways to set things up. The important thing is that you talk to each other about what you want, and then talk to your lawyer, and they can tell you your options on how to paper that.
Yes, it's very important to understand that ownership of equity isn't necessarily part and parcel with voting rights. Okay, I can own a bunch of a company. I can own 51% of a company, but I don't have to have 51% of the voting rights. You, as incorporators and people who are forming the corporate governance structure that is ultimately going to guide your company as it grows, have the ability to do these sorts of things. You're not bound, just as you aren't bound by the ideas of other people. You know, your ability to structure your company equally has the ability to be flexible. It's very important to understand that that the structure needs to be there, you know, not only for the present, but in the future, when you are raising additional money and maybe you're going to have a liquidity event or a sale of some sort. Personally, one of the things I like in working with entrepreneurs and VCs, I'm a big fan of warrants for people. Warrants, as you know, is somebody, essentially the ability to buy a share at a set price. If you have founders or co-founders who are insisting on high levels of equity, I find that giving them warrants to buy them actually takes care of a lot of the issues, because once they have the right to buy them, but two, they also have to show up with the cash to do it. There's a lot of bluster, as you might imagine, when you're dealing with nascent ventures. The other thing I like are setting milestones for equity awards, especially when you're working with somebody else. You don't have to give all the equity out at once. You know, you can have something, if the company hits this amount of revenue or something, or you hit, you know, we make a deal with Amazon or some company in the neighborhood, you can set milestones in your operating agreements. You can be creative in terms of how you want your compensation structure to work and how you want the people that are around you to be motivated to make the company grow. And it's only limited by your imagination, really. I know everyone gets all hung up on, well, there's Series A, Series B. We have to, you know,
yeah.
Blah, 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 you know, oh gosh, you know, someone has options. Oh gosh, I have to have options too. Don't be constrained by that. You know, there are lots of different ways to create capital structures that work for your group and for your needs, and how you think there's going to be down the road. Because ultimately what happens, and Jill, I'm sure you and I have, you know, made our billable targets more than one occasion by cleaning up corporate messes that people have created, where somebody just starts putting stuff in the share book. It's like, all right, they get 10%. Oh, they've got I'm giving them an option. Did you ever approve it? You know, did you go through the corporate minute? You know, did you go through the corporate procedure to do these things? And then suddenly you realize you've had this, you know, this total mess of a structure that's not working for anybody. And God forbid you ever went to a venture capital company that was doing diligence on you. They'd wonder what the heck you're doing. That's
yeah.
Usually when these folks come to us, right, John?
and you, it costs, you know, twice as much to close the deal because you've got to clean up the books before mm-hmm. you can close the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Doubles your transaction cost. But it also brings up another issue that I run into often, usually with, you know, first-time entrepreneurs, usually with folks who you know, are younger and maybe haven't worked for other companies before, but it's the sort of understanding, I want to say the role of the lawyer, but it's more than that. So for me, it's not my job to design your deal. It's not my job to design your company. I can advise you and say, oh, I've seen people do this, or I've seen people do that, or this has risks or other risks. But mostly it's my job to paper what you want. And it's your job to know what you want. And I'm not saying this to be mean or to say you should know what you want, but it's your company. You know? And so, you know, that the form shouldn't drive the function. The function should drive the form. The form is my job. The function is the client's job. And so, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, what, how do I form a company, my entity, my, you know, the equity, you know, you should have an idea. And you know, this doesn't happen out of thin air. It can happen in dialogue with your attorney. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had clients come to me and say, hey, this guy wants to invest. Can you draw it up? I'm like, draw what up? You know, what are the terms? How much? Like, is it debt? Is it equity? Is it like, draw what up? You know, what's
that's the worst?
What?
That's the worst. It's like, well, how much are they getting? What do you mean, how much are they getting? Yeah. You know, do you know what percentage you've just sold your company for?
Right. and so, yeah, I mean, you know, Jonathan, you asked, what do you advise? But my first question is usually, what do you want? Yeah. Where are you trying to go? What are you trying to do?
And that's an interesting point, too, because, you know, there comes like this also this notion of, okay, yes, do, you know, do what you want. Like you're saying, share with your lawyer what you want. But then also it's like, don't be too different than like what else is out there, right? Because if you're doing something that's so different or new, the people that are either investing in you or whatever be like, this looks too weird. No, thank you.
And that's part of the advice. Like, do you want to attract outside investors? Do you want to do a Series A with traditional venture funds? Then part of the advice your attorney is going to give you is they're going to expect to see a Delaware corporation, you know, depending on what kind of investors. So that's, you know, that's the advice. That's the risk, right? That's my job to say, okay, you know, we can do that. Here's the risk. So you've told me you've got these six goals. If we do these three, it makes it harder to do the other three. You know, and that's, you know, and that's the advice that you get. If you are going to do a crowdfunding, or if you're going to grow organically, or if you're raising money from, you know, blockchain investors who are into novel and less traditional, then that calculus changes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there is a limit to being exotic. I mean, you know, those of us in the blockchain space have, you know, gone through the drill of people being creative with SAFs, which are simple agreements for future tokens, which, you know, the SEC has pretty much said are, you know, are part and parcel securities, you know, because they have been, the nature of those instruments has been, I guess, abused, I guess, is the best way to put it, by the capital, by those trying to raise capital. I don't know how much of it's intentional, but whatever the case, people were getting very creative in certain things, you know, doing convertible, you know, things that convert, things that trigger, you know, that trigger creation of other share classes and things like that, or the, you know, debt. You know, I mean, there's a place for doing debt deals. You know, debt is great because you're not giving up equity, but, you know, be prepared to really explain how you're going to be repaying people and how you're maintaining, you know, good corporate form in honoring your financial obligations. So, you know, there's actually very good reasons to keep your company insular and not, you know, open to investment from other people.
Yeah.
You may want to protect it. So, you know, it's all those sorts of things you need to think about.
Yeah, well, I feel like we could talk hours on this, but we're out of time, unfortunately. So I'd love to give you both kind of a final word of advice or thoughts to leave everybody with.
Okay, sure. Just like Clint Eastwood said, you have to know your limitations. Don't aim for the stars by all means, but you know, don't try to tokenize nuclear power plants. And, be realistic in your goals, and ultimately, share those goals openly with good counsel. You know, at the time, you in your heart believe that your venture is something more than an idea.
Yeah, I would say definitely I would pull the trigger on finding good counsel sooner rather than later. I know it's self-serving to say that, but there are ways to get strategic legal advice early that help you with your product roadmap. They help you with your business roadmap. And you don't need to be, paying a legal bill every month. Like I said, if you get good strategic advice early and then check in, and honestly, I like to tell clients, okay, here's when you need to come back. You know, if this happens or if that happens, or if you're getting ready to do this other thing, you need more advice. But here's the advice that'll get you, from point A to point C. And once you get to point C, you need to come back. So I prefer that approach rather than watching somebody get all the way to Z and then having to untangle and in the regulatory space, doing voluntary disclosures or trying to get licenses for things that should have been licensed already, or losing a big part of your market because it wasn't actually legal for you to be doing that business. Better to know ahead of time than trying to undo it afterwards.
Yeah, I think I'll add one thing. Jill, you brought up some very good points. But the moment you think you're going to go out and get money from somebody else, then it is absolutely positively time to talk to somebody. If it's not a lawyer, some other person who has been involved in these sorts of things, one of your peers, one of the people that are here tonight, they have a sense of where to guide you. And it's like, you really need to think about these sorts of things before you start engaging in what I call random acts of marketing that the regulators tend to take a lot of umbrage about. I'll share this anecdote before we go, but I'm representing a group right now that has a website. They haven't sold anything, but they have the word offer on their website, and they have a token and offer. Some state securities regulator, they spend their time doing Google search. They search for these things, and you have to think these things through, and your counsel can help you, and your friends can help you a lot. So don't be afraid to ask for help.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd like to leave everybody from the founder side of it, of working with counsel, is the more you can have prepared for counsel, the better, right? Going along to what Jill was saying is like, hey, write this up for me. What I would always try to do is like actually prepare the document ahead of time, or write the contract ahead of time, or even find a different contract and write it. And then that way I could have my counsel review it. And as opposed to saying like draft this from zero, you reduce your legal bills that way too. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for joining us on this call. Thank I appreciate you, it. I look forward to when we can see you in person, but this will do for now. Thank you everybody for listening. Make sure that you are subscribed to TF Labs across our different social channels. Please also make sure that you're following our YouTube channel, and you'll get to listen to this there. We're going to go ahead and go back into the lounge and we'll just wrap this up. Everybody can kind of leave as they want to. But again, thank you everybody for being here, helping us figure this out. And, you know, I feel comfortable enough that I want to do this more often. So I appreciate all of your help and helping me realize that. I'll see you all in the lounge.